Well, thank you. It's good to see so many out tonight. I got a question for you. How many are here tonight that were not here this morning? Show of hands. All right. You, I expected. Anybody else? Just a few? Okay. So I've already introduced myself and the ministry this morning. I won't go through that again. I will mention very quickly something to do with the resource table at the back. You may have noticed that we didn't bring enough books. It appears that you folks have bought quite a few items, and so did people in other churches before today. And so you'll notice a lot of them are marked last copy. Don't panic. Just talk to us at the table back there. And if it is the very last one, if somebody's already got dibs on it, so to speak, we can order you one, or you know, you may be able to actually take that last one. We just want to make sure you're aware of that. You ever notice that kids ask some really good questions? Right? Last night I had some kids in the Montague Church. Boy, their hands were shooting up every couple minutes. They had all kinds of good questions. Now, sometimes those questions that children ask are rather challenging, and we're not necessarily prepared for what they ask. A great example is for myself, when I was probably 9 or 10 years old, I forget what grade exactly, but I remember being taught in school that it takes 9 months to have a baby. And, I'm the youngest of 7 children, and so there was a lot of family history before I came along. But I knew the birth dates of all my older siblings, so I knew that I had an older brother and an older sister who were born just about 8 months apart in the same year. I was pretty good at math. So I went home and I asked my mother what was going on. Was one of them premature? You know, because I learned that word that day. Well, that's when I found out that my brother was adopted. I don't know when they were planning to tell me about it, but I kind of forced the issue. Children do ask some very interesting questions from time to time. And one of the classic ones, of course, is, why is the sky blue? I think I was in grade 11 when I learned the scientific answer to that one. And then, of course, there's the one we all look forward to. Where do babies come from? Don't worry, I'm not getting into that one tonight. Parents, you can deal with that one on your own. But an even bigger question than that everybody has at some point in time is, where did everything come from? Right? As human beings, we always have to ask that question. We look around at the world around us. We see the stars. We see the trees and the animals. We see all these living things. And we say, well, where did all this come from? And there's two basic explanations. On one hand, was it perhaps random chance natural processes that took place over long, long periods of time, like billions of years? Or was it all, in fact, designed or created? Now, there are other explanations that kind of come into play as well, but these are the two main ones that we're going to look at tonight. Now, of course, being a Christian, I look to see what the Bible has to say about it. If we look at Genesis 1, start at verse 11 here, and God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. We go further down to verse 21. God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And then in verse 25, God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. You see a pattern here? God's creating all of these different living creatures, these different types of living things according to their kinds. Now in verse 26, God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock. So there's something a little bit different when God decides to create man, right? Creating man distinct from all of the other living creatures, but giving them dominion over the rest. And creating them after God's own image or after his own likeness. But you notice the pattern all the way through that chapter is each of these type of creatures is created according to its kind to reproduce after its kind. Not one thing turning into another, right? So dandelions make dandelions, apple trees make apple trees, cows make cows, right? That's what we observe in our world. And we see tremendous design everywhere. In fact, even the very famous atheist Richard Dawkins once wrote, "We have seen that living things are too improbable and too beautifully designed to have come into existence by chance." Now, please understand, Richard Dawkins does not believe in a designer or a creator of any kind. He's an atheist. He doesn't believe that that happened. He believes in random chance. But he's admitting here in his book that everything really does look as if it was designed. No, Richard Dawkins believes in evolution. And there's a couple of different definitions for evolution out there. And they might get a little confused from time to time. One definition goes like this, and we borrowed this from Gerald Kirkut. He said that it's the theory that all the living forms in the world have arisen from a single source, which itself came from an inorganic form. It's a pretty good overarching definition of the idea of evolution, that everything started from a single cell living organism, and from that, everything else evolved and developed over time. Nobody knows where that single-celled organism came from, but we'll talk about that a little more later. Now, this idea was largely popularized by a fellow named Charles Darwin. Ever hear of him? Yeah, he wrote a book back in 1859, commonly known as The Origin of Species. You can see the full title on the screen there. But basically, he wasn't the first person to ever talk about this idea of evolution. But he popularized the idea that there was a single cell living organism and everything evolved gradually, naturally after that, because he observed change in living things. And so he began making speculations on that. How did this all come about? And he came up with this notion of the evolutionary tree of life. And we start with that single cell living organism there at the bottom. And over deep time, changes happen generation after generation, and new types of creatures start to evolve and branch out into different kinds of creatures like we see today. I wonder if this idea has had any effect on our world and maybe on people's faith. Atheist Frank Zindler laid it out this way in a debate. He said, "The most devastating thing, though, that biology did to Christianity was the discovery of biological evolution. Now that we know that Adam and Eve never were real people, the central myth of Christianity is destroyed. If there never was an Adam and Eve, there never was an original sin. If there never was an original sin, there is no need of salvation. If there is no need of salvation, there is no need of a Savior. And I submit that puts Jesus, historical or otherwise, into the ranks of the unemployed." He's laying the logic right out there. If evolution is true, and he believes that evolution is, then it destroys the gospel because there's no original Adam and Eve, there's no original sin, therefore no need of a Savior. I mentioned another fellow this morning that had the same sentiment. And so that's a notion that can have a profound effect on the way people think about the world and even their faith. Now, there are some folks that try to put the two views together, like I mentioned this morning, that maybe God used evolution in some way in order to create. Unfortunately, I think folks that are trying to put those ideas together are not necessarily thinking it all through. There's some dire consequences to that line of thinking. It leads to another question that people sometimes have. And here's another big one. Why is there so much pain and suffering in the world? Right, that's one of the big questions people ask. Doesn't matter what background you're from. Why is there all this pain and suffering in the world? And if we start thinking about God, we might ask, well, why does God allow all that pain and suffering? Well, if you're an atheist and you believe in that there's no God and everything just happened randomly, then the answer to that question is, that's just tough. That's the way it is. You'll hear quotes like that. Obviously, there's going to be pain and suffering if everything just happened on its own. There's no real sense of right or wrong. On the other hand, if we look biblically, we know that God originally created the heavens and the earth very good. And there was no sin, and there was no death, there was no bloodshed, no disease, the pain and suffering wasn't there. But then Adam sinned, and because of that sin, the curse came on all of creation. Now we have pain, we have death, we have all of those things until God restores a new heavens and a new earth. We have that hope. Now, one day, this fallen world will be replaced by new heavens and earth for eternity, where we can live with God with no pain, no death, and so on. On the other hand, if we try to put the two notions together and we say, well, God used evolution to create, then I'm sorry to say what we're really kind of saying is that God used millions of years of pain and suffering in order to create. And that causes a crisis of faith for some folks when they start thinking about what kind of a God would do that sort of thing. There's another atheist named Jacques Monod. He said, the struggle for life and elimination of the weakest is a horrible process. I am surprised that a Christian would defend the idea that this is the process which God more or less set up in order to have evolution. He's not the first person that's ever understood this problem here, this contradiction, if you will. I don't know if anybody here has ever heard of Charles Templeton. He was a rather well-known evangelist back in the 50s, friends with Billy Graham. He was even more famous than Billy for a while. And he used to preach at massive crusades here in Canada. Here he is in Fredericton in 1953, preaching to 1,000 people, preaching the gospel. Well, what happened with Charles is that he didn't have a lot of theological education, so he went off to seminary at Princeton University. Along the way, while he was there, he learned about evolution, and he began to accept the concept of evolution. And so things started to happen for him. And unfortunately, here's something he wrote in a book. Just before he died, he wrote a book called Farewell to God: My Reasons for Rejecting the Christian Faith. This was an evangelist. He said, I believe that there is no supreme being with human attributes, no God in the biblical sense, but that life is the result of timeless evolutionary forces having reached its present transient state over millions of years. And that was his line of thinking just before he died. So this evolutionary idea can have a dire effect on people's faith. We've seen that over and over again. Cornell professor Dr. William Provine put it this way. He said, let me summarize my views on what modern evolutionary biology tells us loud and clear. And I must say that these are basically Darwin's views. There are no gods, no purposeful forces of any kind, no life after death. When I die, I am absolutely certain that I'm going to be completely dead. That's just all. That's going to be the end of me. There is no ultimate foundation for ethics, no ultimate meaning in life, and no free will for humans either. Why did this guy ever get up in the morning? Pretty bleak outlook, but that's... Now, this fellow was raised in the church as a young man, went off to school, learned evolutionary biology, and taught it for many years, and as far as we know, he died an atheist. But he's laying that out there. Now, I had mentioned that there's more than one definition for evolution. Here's another one that you may hear. You may hear a definition that goes something like this. That evolution is a process that results in heritable changes in a population spread over many generations. In other words, change over time. And we observe that. Right? We observe that sort of thing. We observe a population of any type of creature over time, and you'll see heritable changes over time. Different traits will become more dominant in a population than other traits. You can call that natural selection, if you will. Or anybody that's ever done any breeding of any kind of livestock knows you can use artificial selection. You can deliberately breed certain traits in or out of a population. If you want faster horses, you want fatter cattle, you can do that by breeding. That would be artificial selection. And so there is a certain amount of change that can happen over time in a population of any type of living thing. But is it the same as the other kind of evolution that Darwin and Kirkut talked about, that everything comes from a single-celled common ancestor? See, this is the kind of change that Darwin observed many, many years ago when he went on his voyage around the world on the Beagle. He went out and he observed things like groups of finches on the Galapagos Islands. And he noted that these finches all had some similarities, but they also had differences in the size and the shape of their beaks. So he reasoned they must have all been related to other finches on the mainland, but something's going on here to cause these changes. And he realized that the different size and shape of beak had something to do with the availability of food where they were. It looked as though they had adapted to their environment. And so what he was observing really was natural selection in action. Now, he used that term a lot as well, but he didn't invent it. A fellow named Edward Blythe came up and talked about natural selection 20 years before Darwin's book. He was a zoologist and a pharmacist. He wrote articles on natural selection. But see, he saw it just as a process of culling. And we understand this. You have a certain environment, animals that have traits that are conducive to that environment, give them a survival advantage, they're going to survive, they're going to reproduce, and they'll continue on. While other creatures that have different traits that don't give them as much of a survival advantage, well, they're more likely to die out. And so that's the kind of natural selection or change that we tend to observe. This is what Darwin was observing. Understand something about Charles Darwin is that by the time he started writing his book, he already believed that the earth was many millions of years old. Right? He read a book about geology, convinced him that the earth had formed gradually like that over many millions of years. He started to apply that to his own thinking. He goes out and observed natural selection, which is an actual thing, fits in a creationist model, I might add. But then he extrapolated that over deep time. Now, extrapolation is a useful technique we can use to make predictions, but it can go too far. I'll give you a good example. I mentioned I have a couple of grandchildren. My grandson was actually quite a long baby when he was born. He was 23 3/4 inches long. So we'll say he was 24 inches long when he was born. Now, when he was 2 years old, they measured his height to be 34 inches, which is to say he had grown 10 inches in 2 years, or an average of 5 inches a year. Make sense? Now, if we extrapolate that, what we've observed there, then that would mean by the time he's 10 years old, he should be 6'2". When he gets to be 18, he ought to be 9'6". Imagine how tall he'll be when he's my age. See, we can laugh at that because we know there's limitations to how much any living thing can grow, right? But it's an indication of what can happen if we extrapolate something too far beyond what we can actually observe. And that's what Darwin has done, and many others since him. See, one thing that Darwin didn't know about was this thing called DNA, this tiny molecule that's in all living cells that contains the instructions that an organism needs to develop and live and reproduce. It's coded instructions to make that organism into whatever it's going to be, right from your very first cell. So if we take Darwin's idea of that single-cell living organism, never mind where that came from. But if we want to take that and then it's going to have a certain amount of information coded in its DNA. Your DNA is all coded in 4 chemical letters in various combinations. And so there's going to be a certain amount of information in the DNA of that single-celled creature. And the simplest single-celled creature we know of that can reproduce, it has just under 600,000 of those chemical letters. If we want that thing to evolve over time and change and grow and develop into eventually a human being, well, human beings have 3 billion base pairs of those chemical letters in their DNA. So that means that single cell needs to gain a whole lot of new information in order to become a human being with things that it doesn't have. Hair and eyes and skin and organs, all these things that the single cell doesn't have. It's a massive increase in new genetic information. Here's another way to think of it in terms of what evolution needs to occur to come from a common ancestor. Let's suppose we surmise that a reptile can evolve into a bird. Well, in order for that to happen, that reptile has to gain information to code for new traits that it doesn't already have. It's going to need a different bone structure, for example. It's going to need an inbuilt navigation system for flight. It's going to need a wing structure and feathers for the same reason. And it's going to even need a different type of breathing apparatus than what it has now. These are all things that the reptile doesn't have, but if he's going to evolve into a bird, he's going to need to gain that new information. The question is, can natural selection, which Darwin observed and which has been observed ever since, can that create new information in order to evolve one type of creature into another type of creature? It's not so much a question of the amount of information. It's not even a question of the amount of time, because that was Darwin's idea. If something can change this much in a short amount of time, given enough time, anything can evolve into anything. No, it has more to do with the direction of the change. I'll give you a simple analogy for how natural selection works. Let's take a population of dogs as an example. And we're just going to look at one trait. We'll look at the length of fur. Now, all of your genetic information comes in pairs, half of it from mom, half of it from dad. And so there's going to be some variations there. And there's going to be different versions of different genes or alleles. And so in this population of dogs, we got a mom and a dad. They've both got medium length fur. They've each got the a gene to pass on long fur and also a version to pass on short fur. Now, when they have offspring, they will each pass on one of the versions of that gene to each of their offspring, but not necessarily the same one. So you'll end up with different combination in each of the offspring. Some of those offspring will receive the long-haired gene from one parent, short-haired gene from the other, or vice versa, and they'll end up with medium-length fur. Some of them will get the short-haired gene from both parents, so they'll logically have short fur. And then some will get the long hair gene from both parents, and they'll end up with long fur. Make sense so far? Already in one generation, we've got differences between these siblings, right? You can see that in your own children, right? Now, let's suppose we take that population of dogs and we send them up to the Arctic, where it's really, really cold and the wind blows. Of those dogs, which ones do you think are most likely to survive long term? Most likely, the ones with long fur are going to survive better. The other ones with short and medium length fur are more likely to die out over time in those harsh, cold conditions. Now, what happens if you've got these dogs left with this long fur? Once they have offspring, what length of fur do you think they'll have? They're going to have long fur because that's the only genetic information they've got now. Now, the evolutionist looks at that and says, hey, that's evolution right there. Look, they've adapted to their environment. They've survived. They've changed. But did they gain any new information? No, they lost information. They have the one gene that gives them a survival advantage there, but they've lost the ability to generate the short hair because they've lost that genetic information. And so now if we were to take that same population of dogs, take them to the Mojave Desert or somebody really, really, someplace really warm, they're going to be crying for that short-haired gene. And they can't get it back, right? Because it's got nothing to do with being in an environment and then your system says, okay, I've got to change to adapt. All it can really do is select from whatever genetic information is already there. And they can't pass on the short-haired gene to their offspring. So in that environment, they're more likely to die out and be less likely to survive. And so in other words, what I'm saying is natural selection is in fact change over time, but it's change in the wrong direction. It's a loss of genetic information, whereas evolution requires a massive increase in genetic information pretty much out of nowhere. And that we haven't observed. Now, we certainly do see tremendous variation in different types of dogs and elsewhere. And creationists and evolutionists kind of agree that all dogs around today evolved or changed or descended from some wolf or dog-like ancestor. We would call that a created kind. We would, of course, disagree on the amount of time that that took. We would say it didn't take that long. Happened, a lot of it happened since Noah's flood. But you can see similarities within different types of canine kinds. And certainly we see this kind of diversity. I mean, there's a dog, for example. And this is a dog. This is a dog. And they tell us this is a dog. See, right there, that belies evolution to me right there, because that's not an improvement on anything. The only way that little guy survives is if someone carries him around in her purse and feeds him treats. If anyone has a dog like that, I'm sorry. But it's part of the dog kind, right? It's part of that variation. And we can expand that and we can see there's many different types of creatures that would be part of that canine kind. Wild dogs, dingoes, foxes, wolves, all different types of species of dog. But you notice they're all sort of somewhat related to one another. We see that kind of variation within the created kind, according to their kinds, as we heard in Genesis 1. But what we don't see is one type of creature evolving into a totally different type of creature. Zoologist Walter Feit put it this way. He said, "The very name selection implies that you're choosing between two or more variants. So that means the end result is extinction of one in favor of the other, like those dogs. Natural selection never increases the number of variants. It only decreases them. So how does a mechanism that makes less and less end up making more and more?" See, this is where those two definitions of evolution get confused. A biology teacher can say, "I see evolution happening all the time. There's all this change." But it's changed in the wrong direction to go from a single cell common ancestor to everything else. I'll give you one more analogy for this. Let's suppose we have a unicycle. It's got certain parts in it, right? It's got a wheel and pedals and so on. Now, if we want to go from a unicycle to a bicycle, what can we select from the unicycle to go to the bicycle? We got the wheel, we got the pedals, but then we need a second wheel. We need a chain. We need handlebars, right? We need more parts than are what available. You can't select enough from the unicycle to make the bigger and more complex bicycle. And if you go a little farther to a moped or a motorcycle, it's the same idea. Some similar parts there, but we need some new things that aren't available to select from the bicycle. And that's what we run into with natural selection. It doesn't work in that direction. So we go back to that evolutionary tree of life idea that Darwin had. Once upon a time, it was believed that creationists were teaching that God created all existing species as they are today in the beginning and nothing's ever changed, right? Sort of like a lawn. And of course, we see that change over time, so obviously that's not true. But what creationists actually teach is that God created according to their kinds, and we see variation within those kinds. Canine kind, equine kind, etc. You can see that variation within those and amongst human beings. Amongst all these different types of living things have variation within those groups, but we don't see a transition between those. Now, somebody could be thinking, okay, well, wait a minute. What about mutations? We hear about mutations all the time, and natural selection could act on those mutations and make some changes. And if we get enough mutations, we can all be superheroes. Tell you what, get into some of these comic book movies long enough, and you go, wow, the science here is just, yeah, no, they're making stuff up. Mutations are a real thing, but that's not how they work. Mutations are essentially copying errors in your DNA. Remember I mentioned those four chemical letters that make up DNA? Well, what happens when the cells divide and copy themselves, over time, copying errors happen in the DNA strand. There's mechanisms in place to prevent some of those errors, but some do get through. And so we get these mistakes over time. Maybe one letter gets substituted for another, or another one gets inserted in a place it wasn't supposed to be. Something gets, shifted around. And these have an effect, obviously, on the DNA code because it codes for information. So let's suppose I were to take a piece of paper like this. Once upon a time, there was a little girl named Goldilocks. Suppose I put that on a piece of paper and I pass that to one of you and I say, I want you to copy that on another piece of paper, pass the copy to the next person, and then that person make another copy of the copy and pass the copy. And you remember the telephone game, right? Always pass on the copy you received, never the one before, never the original. What do you think is going to happen after a while? Probably going to be some copying errors over time. And so in a while, we'll have something like, once upon Tim, there was a whittle grill named Goldilocks. Now, that's kind of funny, but we still kind of understand what it's saying there. But if we pass that paper around to thousands, millions, billions of people, eventually we're going to get the works of Shakespeare. No. But that's what evolutionists would like us to believe. That those mutations that essentially mess things up, if you get enough of them, you're going to get something bigger and more complex and better than what you had before. But that's not the way mutations work most of the time. They generally mess things up. Now, never mind the works of Shakespeare. Dawkins also said this. He said, there is enough information capacity in a single human cell to store the Encyclopedia Britannica, all 30 volumes of it, 3 or 4 times over. For you young people, an encyclopedia is this set of books we used to have. It's before Google, It's a massive amount of information. But he's saying DNA in a human cell contains a whole lot more information even than that. But even there, if you took an encyclopedia and ran it through a computer program that was programmed to make an error every once in a while, eventually you get something you can't even read. Dr. Lee Spentner once observed, all point mutations that have been studied on the molecular level turn out to reduce the genetic information and not to increase it, taking something away or breaking something, and it doesn't work the way it was supposed to. Now, what about beneficial mutations? We've heard of those. There are such things as beneficial mutations. They tend to be kind of few and far between, however. Here's an example of one that Darwin observed, again, on his voyage. He went to the island of Madeira near Portugal, and he observed some beetles there that didn't have any wings. Now, Madeira is a windy island. I think anybody here familiar with a windy island? Yeah. What was happening is that some of these beetles would tend to fly up in the air. They'd get blown out into the ocean, right? They'd die. Well, what happened is a mutation came along in some of the beetles that they were unable to grow wings. And so they didn't fly into the air. They didn't get blown into the ocean. They survived, and they reproduced, and they became the dominant population on the island. Now, the evolutionist says, look, there's evolution in action. They've adapted. They've survived. Did they gain any new information? No, they lost information. And generally speaking, not having wings for a beetle is not a good deal. Just happened to be a benefit in that particular environment, but not always. Another great example is sometimes we hear about antibiotic resistance in bacteria, and that's touted as evolution as well. Take, for example, the bacteria Helicobacter pylori. It's the one that causes stomach ulcers. Well, we determined this can be treated with antibiotics. And the way it works is the bacteria has an enzyme in it that when it is in the presence of the antibiotic, The antibiotic will stick to that enzyme, turn it into a poison, and kill the bacteria. Now, occasionally what happens is a bacteria will get a mutation that causes it to be unable to develop that enzyme that it needs for other things. So when the antibiotic is there, it's got nothing to stick to, doesn't turn into a poison, and the bacteria survives. Great. That bacteria survived and adapted. Isn't that evolution? But did it gain any new information? No, it lost information. So you've got something here that is, it's a trait that it already has. The ones that survive aren't the ones that developed something new. The ones that survived are the ones that already had a trait that allowed it to survive from the antibiotic. And it was because of a loss of information. And so these beneficial mutations do occur, but they're very few and far between. Has there been enough time, I wonder, for enough beneficial mutations to happen to say, let's have an ape-like creature eventually evolved into human beings? There's a fellow by the name of J.B.S. Haldane, a geneticist from back in the 50s. He was doing some research, and he came up with something that's now known as Haldane's Dilemma. He posited this notion: suppose you have a population of 100,000 ape-like creatures about 10 million years ago. Now, that's further back than anybody has ever surmised that human beings first started evolving from ape-like creatures. Now, let's suppose two of those apes, a male and a female, were born with the same beneficial mutation, which in order for it to be any good in the long term, it needs to be taken over in the whole population. Otherwise, it's going to die out with those two. So let's suppose that that beneficial mutation is so good that it allows them to survive and the rest of the population all dies out. Now, let's imagine that that male and female ape are able to reproduce and replenish that entire population of 100,000 apes. Now all of them have the beneficial mutation in one generation, about 20 years. A highly unlikely scenario, but you'll see why in a minute. So let's suppose that unlikely scenario were to happen every generation for 10 million years. Well, that would be about 500,000 generations, therefore 500,000 new beneficial mutations in the population. Sounds pretty good, right? Problem is, 500,000 equates to less than 0.02% of the human genome. Definitely not enough to get an ape-like creature to become a human being. Now, you may have heard the notion at some point that there's only about 1% or 2% difference between the chimp and the human genome. Yeah, that's been discredited a long time ago. That was based on early research, you know, partial of each genome, not very thorough at all. Much more thorough research has been done and found that the difference is at least 5%, and some are suggesting now maybe up to 15%. But even if it is a 1% difference, that's still huge. I mean, for a 5% difference, for example, it would be 150 million of those chemical letters we talked about. But a more realistic estimate, according to Haldane, would be one happening maybe every 300 generations. So there hasn't been anywhere close to enough time for enough beneficial mutations to happen to cause an ape-like creature to evolve into a human being. Evolutionists are trying to find ways around that, but to my knowledge, this hasn't been solved yet. However, mutations do still accumulate in all living things, including human beings. We accumulate new mutations throughout our lifetime, and some of those mutations are heritable, which means they get passed on to the next generation. Now, most of those mutations are destructive or deleterious or neutral at best, which means they're not super, super bad, right? So really what happens is they kind of fly under the radar, right? We tend to think that natural selection is going to take out the bad mutations, but natural selection doesn't work at the molecular level. In order for natural selection to take out a bad mutation, you got to take out the whole organism. And that's a tremendous cost. But occasionally something really bad comes along and, you know, causes certain members of the population to die out. But meanwhile, a whole lot of other more neutral mutations continue to accumulate in the population. Now, maybe that's not such a bad thing. It's a little bit like rust on a car. You know, you get a little bit of rust on your car, it still runs, it looks okay. But if it accumulates long enough, you're going to get something that's just completely broken down. And that's what's going on in the human genome. Something called genetic load. A fellow named Dr. John Sanford, a well-known geneticist, has done research on this. And it's estimated that every generation inherits approximately 100 new mutations that the previous generation didn't have. So what does that mean? That means your parents probably had 100 mutations less than what you have. Your children will now have those 100 mutations plus about 100 more. Then the grandchildren will have that plus 100 more, and so on. And so those mutations are accumulating. They're going to be destructive over time. Evolutionists look at this and they say, wow, if we've been around for 200,000 years or more, we should be extinct. Well, maybe not if we've been around a significantly less amount of time than that. In his book, Genetic Entropy, Dr. Sanford created this graph based on a computer program called Mendel's Accountant. He loaded in certain data, like take a population size of, say, 10,000 people and then load in 100 new mutations every generation. And what he found is that over the course of something like 200 generations, that red line represents the general overall fitness of the population anticipated from that. So what does that mean? That means as a human population, we're not going uphill like evolutionists want us to believe. We're actually kind of going downhill. And that's actually consistent with what the Bible says, because we live in a sin-cursed world where all creation groans in futility. And we know everything is subject to decay until the time that God decides to remake this and give us a restored new heavens and new earth. Incidentally, Sanford made another graph using data from a different source. You ever look at the lineages in the Old Testament? You know how Noah lived to be 950, and then after the flood, Shem only lived to be 600. And then you follow the genealogy, and you notice those ages seem to go down rather rapidly, right? Well, Sanford graphed that out, again, over approximately 200 generations, and he came up with kind of a similar graph, oddly enough. Now, this is not proof positive of everything, but it is kind of interesting that that decline in lifespan after the flood seems to kind of correlate to what we're seeing in the genome. Maybe something genetic happened or got lost in that genetic bottleneck. All right, I want to spend a few minutes now talking about information. Because remember, DNA has all the coded information needed for everything that you are and everything that you can do. Well, here's another system of coded information. Y'all recognize that one? Now, if you're as old as I am, you might remember that guy. He used to sing this little song, you remember it? Abkadefka Jekalmanopkushuvixi, sing it with me. No. I don't know if he's still singing it, but that was a ridiculous song because that's not a word. We know that's not a word. But that sequence of letters contains all the information needed to make words in the English language and many others, and then we can make sentences and we can convey information with those letters. But the letters themselves don't really tell us a whole lot. Now, let's suppose I were to put something like this on a paper with orange paint or ink or something. Who can tell me what that says? No? Okay, well, let's say I were to get another piece of paper and I were to put this on it. Who can tell me what that says? Orange, right? No, not just the color of the paint, right? But you recognize the letters, right? We recognize how to pronounce those letters. We can pronounce the word, and we understand the meaning assigned to that word, what it refers to. So let's go back to this one. What is that? Yeah, so you're guessing now. People always can guess it after I've shown them the other word. That's true. If you understand Japanese syllabary, each one of those symbols represents a syllable in the Japanese language, and you'd have to be able to recognize how to sound it out. It's orange. Orange. All right, but you have to be able to understand what the symbols mean and what the word means when you string them together and pronounce them. There's meaning attached to that. But was there any information in the paint or the ink or any other means I might use to write a word? No, but there's information there in the things that we write. So there's something a little bit intangible about information. Philosopher of science Karl Popper noted this. He said, "What makes the origin of life and of the genetic code a disturbing riddle is this. The genetic code is without any biological function unless it is translated." And then he goes on, he said, "But the machinery by which the cell translates the code consists of at least 50 macromolecular components which are themselves coded in the DNA. Thus, the code cannot be translated except by using certain products of its translation." Let me translate that. The information coded in your DNA has to be translated just like we would with any of those letters and words, right? It gets translated by these tiny molecular machines that go along and decode the information. But in order to build the machines that decode the DNA, you have to decode the DNA to get the information to build the machine that decodes the DNA. You get it? Real chicken and egg problem. Just screams intelligent design. How can that possibly evolve by chance? Information expert Werner Goetz said this, "A code system is always the result of a mental process. It requires an intelligent origin or inventor. It should be emphasized that matter as such is unable to generate any code." Remember, the paint doesn't generate code, but the information in those letters does. He said, "There is no known law of nature, no known process, and no known sequence of events which can cause information to originate by itself in matter." That's what you would need to happen in order for evolution to occur out of chemicals. Oddly enough, astrobiologist Paul Davies said something similar. He said, "How did stupid atoms spontaneously write their own software? Nobody knows." He said, "There is no known law of physics able to create information from nothing." Now, please understand, Paul Davies is not a creationist. He doesn't believe in a God or any intelligent designer. He believes that everything came about naturally from nothing by random chance. But he's admitting nobody has a clue how that could possibly occur. How could any information arise out of nowhere? And how could life spontaneously come from those chemicals? Back to Git. He said, "All experiences indicate that a thinking being voluntarily exercising his own free will, cognition, and creativity is required." Right? A thinking being is required to write the works of Shakespeare, or Goldilocks and the Three Bears, or the word orange on a piece of paper. Imagine the level of intelligence required to create the information in DNA. Not to mention how horrendously complex the human cell is even beyond that. I want to show you a short video that illustrates just a little bit of what's going on in our cells on a regular basis. Is that loud enough? Sorry? Okay, hold on. Did you?
A, preparing it for transcription. Inside the polymerase, we see a single-stranded copy of the original instructions being assembled as individual bases are positioned and added to the growing strand. A stop code marks the end of the protein specification, at which point this copy, known as a messenger RNA transcript, exits the polymerase and heads towards a two-part chemical manufacturing machine called the ribosome. While the messenger RNA moves towards the ribosome, transfer RNA molecules attach to specific amino acids in preparation for assembly. As the messenger RNA transcript passes through the ribosome, the process of translation begins. Using the instructions encoded on the messenger RNA as a template, the transfer RNA molecules align specific sequences of bases to corresponding amino acids, creating a protein chain. As this chain exits the ribosome, it is met by chaperones which prevent premature folding, while escorting the protein to a barrel-shaped machine called a chaperonin. This machine helps fold the protein into the precise shape required to perform its function. Although it is unclear how the chaperonin achieves this, we do know that accurate folding is essential in order for the protein to accomplish its intended function. Once the protein is complete, it is released into the cytoplasm to do its job.
Isn't evolution amazing? No, I think when we see something like that, boy, we can agree with the psalmist who said, "For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made," right down to the tiniest molecule. Amazing. Or how about the Apostle Paul in Romans 1:20? "For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." Nearly 2,000 years ago, Paul is pointing out that ever since the beginning of creation, we've been able to look around at what's been created and see God. How much more today? With the things that we know about the cosmos, about galaxies, about the tiniest molecules, microbiology, the tremendous intricacy and detail and design, how much more are we without excuse for seeing Creator God? But there are many in our world who don't see it. Perhaps they've just been inundated with other ideas too much. Maybe they're just a little hard-hearted and they don't want to see it. But we can still try to reach them. We can try to reach the people that we know and prevent them from going down that path toward atheism that Provine mentioned. We've already talked about some of the resources that we have available. I mentioned a few that get into biology especially. Evolution's Achilles' Heels, I talked about this morning, has chapters on DNA and genetic entropy and natural selection. And a great DVD on the subject of why natural selection is not the same as evolution is Dr. Don Batten, "Creatures Do Change, But It's Not Evolution." Goes a little more in-depth and detailed on that subject. And one of our newer DVDs is called Dismantled. Dr. Sanford, who I mentioned before, a geneticist, and Dr. Robert Carter, who also is working a lot in genetics, they're showing that, they're basically taking apart the whole theory of Darwinian evolution based on what we know from genetics alone. And if you really want to get into the human cell and how complex it is, Dr. Carter has The High-Tech Cell, getting very in-depth, showing that the genome codes, as far as we know, on at least four different dimensions. Very, very complex. And I've already mentioned the Creation Answers book a few times. It's got chapters on this subject as well, not as in-depth as some of those DVDs. And if you remember from this morning, I talked about our magazine, Creation Magazine. I won't pass around clipboards tonight because I think most of us were here this morning. But if anybody is interested in subscribing to our quarterly magazine, $7.50 every 3 months, you can come and see us at the back table and fill out a slip there. And you can get hold of a free copy of the magazine and a free DVD if you want to sign up for that tonight. And I don't have a slide for it, but we also have those connect forms I talked about. You can connect with us on Facebook, email, newsletter, InfoBytes, and other ways. All right, are your brains full? That's my favorite talk, but boy, is that full of information, and it's a lot very, very quickly. All right. I think I'll just close in prayer, and then you can come and talk to me at the back before you head out. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for your created world. We thank you that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. We thank you, Lord, for the wonder of your creation. We thank you especially for your gift of salvation through Jesus Christ. We thank you for your great love for us, that you've created this entire created order in order that that we could have a place to live and come to know you, Lord. And we look forward to those new heavens and new earth when there will be no more death or pain and suffering. We ask that you would help us to use some of this information to talk to others we know who have not yet put their faith in Jesus. And we ask for your favor and your blessing as we go from here. In Jesus' name, amen.